This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. This is an exciting week for us. We're putting together the January edition of the Trumpet, collecting material about the aftermath of the election victory of Donald Trump. In our first segment today, we're going to have two interviews. First, we're going to talk about the divisions that the election exposed within America. Second, we'll talk about the reaction within the Jewish state of Israel. We'll talk to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal, about that. In the second segment, we're going to talk about the devastating earthquakes that have rocked New Zealand this week. And in our third segment, we're going to talk with personal trainer Jorg Mardian about some misconceptions about exercise. We know exercise is good for us, but what is its real purpose? We're going to try to get to the truth about the role that exercise can play in good health. And we'll conclude the program by talking about an important lesson in leadership. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Since the election last week, America has experienced quite a lot of protests, even riots, over Donald Trump's victory. How serious is the division within the United States, and how might this play out? Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has written the commentary for our coming print edition of The Trumpet, an article called A House Divided. He says this is pretty serious. I have him here in the studio to talk about this. Hello, Andrew.
Good to be here.
So, obviously, we're seeing the riots and the more physical manifestations of anger and hostility in the streets. In this article, you really focus on the ideological divide between the two sides in America and say that this is really greater than we've seen in a long time in America. Explain what you mean by that.
Right. This is this ideological divide. And I mean, it's not news to anyone. There is almost no point of consensus anymore between Republicans and Democrats. And they've even had some new models coming out proving statistically what most of us have probably already guessed, is that the amount of ideological division between the two parties is greater than any time since the aftermath of the Civil War. We have James Lowe, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Southern California, who's put together this model based on voting records in Congress, showing that in the Civil War time, there really was nothing, almost nothing, that Republicans and the Democrats could agree on. But after Reconstruction over the next century, you actually did start building some consensus to where they probably became closest in the 1960s, where they said there was about 50% overlap between the platforms of the two parties, to where John F. Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson, there could be, during their presidencies, you could introduce bills to lower taxes and both parties would vote for it. Or you could introduce bills to fight communism abroad and both parties would vote for that. The Civil Rights Bill had huge bipartisan support. But then just showing that really that was as close as it got is that since the 70s, especially as you had this this like countercultural new left movement that really took root in the Democratic Party, taking on a more radical left wing social engineering programs, it started to drift apart again. And to where just recently, and it's probably most highlighted by this recent election, it is to a point where there is almost zero overlap between the two parties. It's almost impossible to come up with a bill that will get any bipartisan support. And so that is a level of division that the last time we've seen was 1877, when the Reconstruction era ended.
One interesting point that you make is just the difference in where you're seeing this divide in the country versus, say, in the Civil War era, it was a North and South issue, North versus South. But here we see basically an urban versus rural divide.
Right. Back into when the last time we had this amount of division was right around the Civil War time, where both the city dwellers and the country dwellers in the North were predominantly Republican, and the city dwellers and the country dwellers in the South were primarily Democrat, which was... even as horrible as the Civil War was, though, I mean, that was the geographic divide kind of played to America's favor, and the fact that when hostilities broke out, you had a geographic divide to where you sent soldiers from one region to fight the soldiers from the other region. And even though 600,000 Americans died in that war, very, very few of them were women or children or civilian casualties. It was mostly soldiers. you're getting now this like urban unrest where you have the same amount of division and in a lot of ways even the same amount of hostility with just hurling insults and just the other side is evil and our side is good. It's the same type of division you saw in the Civil War, but it's between the Democratic Party's controlled cities and the Republicans' countries, even blue states like California. The country people still vote Republican. It's just Los Angeles, San Diego, Sacramento, those big urban centers that tip that to the other side, which is dangerous in a way, is that as things get more hostile, I mean, secession isn't really an option. I mean, we are mixed together as one nation, I mean, city versus country, to whereas you start get some of these protesting turning violence, if this escalates into any sort of urban warfare or civil unrest, it would be very much messier than the Civil War ever was, unless something can be done just to heal the fact that we actually have almost like two Americas living within the same borders.
You know, it's interesting to think about this this kind of a divide that you're talking about and just how much power the urban centers have just by virtue of the fact that they're so much more heavily populated. And this controversy that has arisen or re-arisen over the existence of the Electoral College and the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, if you were to remove the Electoral College and purely elect the president based on just counting up the number of votes, it really would heavily tip the scale in favor of the population centers. You know, it would just be these little pockets of people in the big cities throughout the country that would decide how the entire nation was to be governed.
Right. Well, there are over 3,000 counties in America, and half the population lives in 146 of them. That is kind of one of the reasons the founders decided to go with an electoral college instead of a popular vote, is they were worried that a situation like where the people in 146 counties could rule over the other 2,000-some counties. So they kind of did this kind of a complicated system to balance out the urban population centers with the huge rural areas. And so now you do get a lot like Bernie Sanders or former Attorney General Eric Holder, who are saying that, well, to unify America, we need to get rid of the Electoral College so that whoever wins the popular vote will win the election. And they are definitely right that probably would tip the balance of power back in favor of the cities versus the country. But that doesn't unify America. The divide is still there.
So in this article, you quote Abraham Lincoln, the hero of the Civil War, and really probably the singular personality that prevented the country from splitting in two. And he was quoting Jesus Christ, saying, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." Now, that's pretty strong authority backing up that sentiment. Can America stand given these divisions?
Right. Well, that is definitely one. Abraham Lincoln quoting Jesus Christ, he said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." He said, "It will either fall, or it will become all one thing or all the other," which is that the current political division in America, it will either end with the collapse of America and as this divide escalates into rioting and urban warfare, or one side's going to have to give way until it becomes all one. It becomes all Democratic America or all Republican America. You can't have two completely separate ideologies in one country that have zero overlap and zero consensus.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. You can watch for his article, "A House Divided," in the coming edition of the Trumpet Magazine. We're working on this issue, the January issue, sending it to the printer this week. We just received the cover story, the lead-off article from the editor, from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, the title of that, "America's Coming Civil War." That gives you an idea of where he feels this topic is taking us in the United States today. So a blockbuster issue for the Trumpet coming up, and it's awesome to see it coming together this week. You can watch for it in the time ahead on thetrumpet.com. Well, thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In his new booklet, Great Again, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief looks back on the legacy left by the current presidential administration in America. There's a chapter on the ideological connections with communism, another about the deal made with communist Cuba. There's one on the state of race relations in America because of this present administration. There's also a chapter about several foreign policy disasters, including the fracturing of the relationship between the United States and Israel. This is an interesting aspect of Mr. Trump's coming presidential administration that we want to talk about here because of the indications that his could be different from the Obama policy toward Israel. I have Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall via Skype from Jerusalem to talk about this. Hello, Brent.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
So let's start by just talking about what Mr. Trump has said about America's relationship with Israel that might give us some clues as to what would happen under a Trump administration.
He said a number of things over the past few weeks, especially in the lead up to the election, to try and win some more Jewish support. And the biggest thing that got the most press was the fact that he promised to move the United States embassy that's currently in Tel Aviv and move that to Jerusalem to really show that America does recognize Jerusalem as the eternal capital of the Jewish people. Even that's what he said in a statement. It came out just after, remember, we had the White House where they deleted Israel from, I think, the transcript of what President Obama said at Shimon Peres's funeral. It said it was located in Jerusalem, Israel, and they cut out Israel there because the current policy of the United States doesn't recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And yet Donald Trump said he's going to fix that. He's going to move the embassy there. He also had inserted some pretty big changes into the Republican platform in the lead up to the convention. And back in 2012, it talked about, while it was pro-Israel, it did say that we envisioned the Republicans, two democratic states, Israel with Jerusalem its capital, and a Palestine, like they'd still believed in a two-state solution. But with a lot of pushing from Trump's some of his advisors, that got changed so that there's no mention of a two-state solution whatsoever in the Republican platform right now. So from the lead up to the election, Trump was seen as the more pro-Israel, pro-right-wing supporter, kind of like somebody that Netanyahu would like. And even back in 2000, I think it was 13, when Netanyahu came into power again and was reelected, Donald Trump, before he was a president-elect, he gave a message to Mr. Netanyahu and said on YouTube, public message, saying that he supports Mr. Netanyahu, who's a wonderful leader. He's going to be a great leader for Israel. And then the same day that President-elect Trump got voted in just last week, Netanyahu returned the favor and he called him his friend. He looks forward to the strengthening of the alliance between Israel. He concluded his speech, Israel and America, he concluded his speech saying that I'm confident that the two of us can work closely together and will bring the great alliance between our two countries to even greater heights. And then he said, may God bless America, may God bless Israel, and may God bless our enduring alliance. So he was seen even over here in Israel as the more pro-Israel choice because of some of those statements.
Not hard to see why there would be optimism among some Israelis looking at some of these statements that Mr. Trump has made and really hoping that that alliance that has underpinned Israel's security for so long would be restored to something closer to what it has been. But how have the Israeli people responded to the Trump victory?
Well, it is interesting because you have obviously the current government wasn't too happy with the way that they were treated over the past few years by the Obama administration. So they were favoring a change in that regard. But the people themselves, they are pretty split as to who they would have voted for. I think Israelis, had they given the chance to vote, there was a poll that was just the day before the election, they would have voted I've got it here somewhere. I think it said that 41% of Jewish Israelis favored the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, while 31% that they said that they preferred Trump. That's even though that those same people were asked who was better for Israel, and more of them said that Trump would be better for Israel, 37% rather than Hillary Clinton just said 30% of people thought that she would be more favorable towards Israel. And yet, more of them would have still voted for her, it seems. When it comes to American Jews living in Israel, so they would have had a dual citizenship, they would have had the opportunity to vote in the election. The majority of those people that actually voted that were American actually put Trump ahead of Hillary Clinton. And that's in stark contrast to Jews in America who put Hillary Clinton far above Donald Trump.
Why do you suppose the divide between Israeli Jews and American Jews living in America versus Israel?
Right. So you do have this misconception or misunderstanding of what constitutes a Jew generally, because when we think of Jew, we think of somebody that's religious, obviously. And you would find that you have a greater percentage of Jews in Israel that are religious. We would call them Orthodox Jews. That doesn't mean the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim, those that would wear the black and the white. And they're another category. They're obviously religious. But you have Orthodox Jews, which just means they're religious Jews. Now, there is a greater percentage of religious Jews that live in Israel than do in America. Basically, 10% of the Jews in America count themselves as Orthodox, as thoroughly religious people, where that's far higher than in Israel. And if you look at the vote historically, who's voted for Republican over Democrat or more conservative over more liberal, you would find that the conservatives, religious people, they vote Republican or they would vote for Donald Trump. And the less religious they are, the Jewish by identity, in that just being historical identity or ethnicity, they vote Democrat. So in Israel, you have more religious Jews. They're going to care more about the Israel's standing in like Israel's position in the world. So they care. They would want the Republican, obviously, since he is better for Israel. But honestly, a lot of the Jews in America couldn't care less about Israel. As crazy as that sounds, that is truth.
We have an article going up on thetrumpet.com by Callum Wood called Mr. Trump's Promise to Israel. And the question really arises, is he going to be able to follow through on some of the things that he said? I mean, he's talking about moving the capital to Jerusalem. Those are pretty strong. That's a pretty strong promise. Some of these other things that he said, can he do it?
Yeah, and people are hopeful that he can, but people don't know if he can, because a lot of things he has said in the past have been kind of whichever way the wind's blowing of public opinion in some ways. Of course, he has said some obviously strong, he's tapped into somewhat of a nerve in the United States with some really important issues. And he is speaking what the people really do finally get somebody to say in public for them. But we don't know if he's going to back down. And that's the big issue, that some of those people that said that why they're voting for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, at least Israelis over here, they said they'd vote for Hillary Clinton because she's predictable. Yes, we might not like her, but we know her.
Better
we know
devil,
that she
know.
Lies. We know that what she's going to do. With Donald Trump, we don't know. He's a highly unpredictable character. He might get her next week and change his tune with certain things that he said, according to Israel. It would be hard for him to back down from moving the embassy to Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, just because he said it so strongly. But we've seen American presidents do it before, so it might not happen. One note that I would add is that just. And something that took Israelis kind of by surprise that did support Trump was just a couple of days ago with an interview with the Wall Street Journal. He came out and said that the Israeli-Palestinian issue is the war that never ends, and that he hoped to craft a resolution between them. He said, quote, that is the ultimate deal. And as a deal maker, I'd like to do that deal that can't be made. And I'd like to do it for humanity's sake as well. So you can see that he is interested in breaking the deadlock between the Israelis and the Palestinians, where before, 2 months before, he said, basically, Israel, whatever you want to do, we'll support you. And yet, if he makes this personal, if he makes it an agenda item or a legacy item where he does want to, as powerful Mr. Trump, bring a deal to the place where there can't be deals, you can see why that he would probably ask some things of the Israelis that they have not been prepared to give up to this point in considering Palestinian concessions.
Interesting to watch for there. Looking at this relationship specifically between the United States and Israel from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, how do you think a Trump win is significant?
I don't know how it's going to play out, and I don't think Bible prophecy is very clear as far as how his relationship personally is going to be with Israel, apart from the fact that we know that the Israeli American alliance is destined to break. And there have been a number of reports that come out that have said that it's too far gone right now from where it was even, you know, 8 years ago, that no president will be able to rectify it. I don't know if that's the case, if he really wanted to. But Bible prophecy does show that there isn't prophesied a stronger relationship with Israel and America going forward. It is going to continue to weaken, even if the president might want it to be strengthened. The Bible says it's not going to happen.
Well, we appreciate that, Brent. I do just want to mention before we close, you've got a new little project that project that you're launching from Jerusalem, and we can start to hear that this coming Sunday. Is that right? Maybe just give us a 20-second teaser.
Well, the program's going to be a podcast entitled Watch Jerusalem. It's going to have the same name as a website that we're going to be releasing also that's mainly aimed at Israelis called watchjerusalem.co.il. It'll be running on Sunday. And we'll have a podcast that will focus on archaeology, biblical archaeology, and then also news, prophetically significant news from Israel. About half the program will be archaeology, half will be news. And it'll air 10 a.m., I believe, live Central Time on Sunday, and then it'll be once a week for an hour long, and it will be replayed, I think, a couple of times that day. But people can also access it just as the other program on KPCG through SoundCloud and on thetrumpet.com and also at kpcg.fm. And that starts on Sunday.
Well, I want to catch up with you once you've got a program or two under your belt. We'll talk in more depth about what you're doing there and the purpose of it and what we're trying to accomplish. We appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about the reaction in Israel to Donald Trump's victory. And we do have an article going up on the Trumpet site called Mr. Trump's Promise to Israel. You can watch for that. Go to thetrumpet.com to find it. Again, Brent, thanks for your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In the middle of the night, early Monday morning, New Zealand was shaken by a 7.5 magnitude earthquake. Just absolutely huge, devastating earthquake. And in the time since then, there have been hundreds of aftershocks, some of them quite severe. We want to just bring you up to speed on this situation. We have our native New Zealander, Chris Eames, via Skype from Jerusalem. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So this is your home country. I know you've been watching this very closely. Tell us what's been going on this week there.
Yeah, I have been watching it quite closely. I've written an article about it, which should be going up soon on our website, thetrumpet.com. But for a quick summary, like you say, a massive earthquake, 7.5 magnitude, hit New Zealand just after midnight Monday morning. The U.S. Geological Survey actually registered it as 7.8 magnitude earthquake. So there's a bit of discrepancy there, but however way you look at it, a massive earthquake that hit the city of Kaikoura in New Zealand. That's on the east coast of the South Island. It's actually more of a township. So it was a smaller population density there, and there have only been two deaths confirmed so far, fortunately, but just an immense amount of damage from an earthquake that size. Apparently, about 100,000 landslides have been recorded as a result of this earthquake. I thought that was an editorial mistake myself, but it's been widely reported since. As a result of these landslides, they've actually completely sealed off the entrance by road and rail into the township of Kaikoura, completely sealing in the people there. We've got about 600 residents and 1,100 tourists there. It's a big tourist destination for whale watching. That has been sealed off from ground transportation. So there are a number of warships that have actually volunteered to come to New Zealand and provide aid from the US, from Canada, and from Australia. So those warships will be joining the New Zealand warship that is already there in providing aid to these people. And going back to the size of this earthquake, this earthquake was felt in the North Island as far north as Auckland, our largest city. Auckland was severely rattled by it, and that's 400 miles away. And then in the capital city of Wellington, that suffered a tremendous amount of damage, also in the North Island, I think about 130 miles away for that city, our capital city. And that city was on lockdown, essentially. It became essentially a ghost town on Monday as the day dawned. City workers were out to try and check the damage to see if any structural damage was done. Quite a lot of damage was done, and one large office block building is feared to be on the verge of collapsing with structural damage. But as I say, just an immense amount of damage. Fortunately, again, only two people have been confirmed as being killed by this earthquake. New Zealand's Prime Minister, John Key, took a tour of the damaged sites on Monday, and he made an estimate that this is going to cost into the billions of dollars to repair all of this damage, these roads, these railway lines, all of this infrastructure that has been hit and damaged so badly by this earthquake, that it's going to cost into the billions of dollars, something that New Zealand really can ill afford to be spending at the moment.
And just quickly, these aftershocks, how much devastation have those caused? Because there have been, what, how many, 800 aftershocks?
I think we're up to 900 aftershocks now from this earthquake. So these have been massive aftershocks as well, up to 6.3 in their own right on the magnitude scale, 6.3, several in the 5-point margin there. And these aftershocks, again, have just been exacerbating the problem, causing further landslides. And not only the aftershocks, but Wellington itself has been hit by severe weather just since the earthquake. They had forecast 85 mile per hour winds in the city, which would be a problem for throwing around a lot of glass and broken ceramics. They got hit by terrible flooding, actually, really bad flooding over the past 24 hours. So that's really hampering efforts to clean up. So they've had just a double dose of natural disasters here.
Now, it was only 2011 that massive quake hit Christchurch. It seems like that was a 6.3 magnitude quake that seemed to do quite a bit more damage just because of the location of it compared to this that was in a more rural area. But New Zealand is still recovering from that quake, and to be hit with this, well, maybe you could just compare what happened then to now, you know, just to give us a sense of, say, how serious this is by comparison.
Sure. I was actually in Christchurch a couple of weeks ago and talking with several of the residents there, still fresh in their minds, the 6.3 earthquake that you mentioned from 2011. It did an immense amount of damage. Christchurch is the biggest city in the South Island, and because of the location of the earthquake, because of the density of the population there, it actually ended up killing about 185 people, I believe it was, with that earthquake, absolutely wiping out several homes. One of the residents said you could actually stand on one side of the city and look clear across to the other with the amount of flattening that had gone on from the earthquake. So still a lot of the utilities have been under repair. A lot of those were damaged by that earthquake, and this was still fresh in the minds of many people. And actually, if you go there today, there is still a lot of remnants of that 2011 earthquake. And to be talking about it with them, meeting the people that experienced it, little did we know that just 2 weeks later, only 60 miles away further to the north, that this would happen again to the city of Kaikoura.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Chris Eames about these devastating quakes in New Zealand this week. The question always arises when these events happen, why does this happen? Chris has written an article that you can find on thetrumpet.com about this subject, and it addresses it somewhat. We also have our booklet, Why Natural Disasters, that explains catastrophic events like this one from a biblical standpoint. And I highly encourage you to read that book. It's available at thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. You can read that for free. You can download it. You can even order a hard copy of that. But it really does explain why earthquakes in diverse places is going to be a hallmark of the time just ahead of us. And the experience that New Zealanders have had in this past week really is something that we need to be gearing up for more in the time ahead. Well, Chris, we appreciate your time. Thanks for filling us in and keeping up to date with the story.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour.
We know exercise is good for us, but what is its real purpose? Personal trainer Jorg Mardian says a lot of people misunderstand the real purpose for exercise. There are a lot of misconceptions that cause people to exercise for the wrong reasons, in the wrong way, or not to exercise at all. People want their body to look a certain way. They want to build this, get rid of that, look like that picture, fix this perceived imperfection, lose that weight. What is the main point of exercise? We're going to try to get to the truth about what constitutes real fitness and the role that exercise can play in that. I have Jorg here via Skype from his studio in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Hi, great to be here.
So in your business, you talk to a lot of people. They'll come to you for a lot of reasons. They want to start this program or that. What are some of the misconceptions that you see in the people that are coming to you?
Well, when you look at fitness and the ideas that people have about fitness, it really is crazy. Most people, well over 90%, come in and they say, I want to lose weight. You know, I want to hire a trainer to help me to lose weight and to find the best workouts to do that. And now what we find in the business is that the business has actually been what we call hijacked by advertising. And it gives us this notion that we can do military-style workouts, undo long military-style workouts to exhaustion, and that works for burning the calories and achieve a certain look. And that's not true. I mean, you can lose a certain amount of calories with a workout, but I've heard extremes of 1,500 calories per workout. And unless you're an Olympic athlete, and you're in the pool for 5 or 6 hours, that's not going to happen. And that's just an inconvenient truth that the advertising business doesn't want you to know. I mean, they want you to pound that treadmill and say you've just burned 900 calories when in fact it's 300 or 400. And then you overeat again. And then the other thing is looking at the advertisements in fitness magazines. You know, you can hardly turn an internet webpage or open a magazine without seeing airbrushed images of perfection. I mean, absolute perfection. There's not a wrinkle. There's not a flaw in men or women shown on those web pages or the magazines. And that's so unrealistic for the body types that we all have. There's so many different body types. And, you know, people don't realize that they can't fit their body type into this wafer-thin image that's presented by the media. I mean, you just about have to kill yourself through one means. A way to work out. So I can't work people out 3, 4, 5 hours a day to achieve this look. You're just not going to last in the business. What it does is it makes money for the advertising business, which calls themselves fitness advertising, but it has nothing to do with it. It's simply greed, and it's giving the wrong type of image, and it's feeding that image, and people are buying into it falsely.
So this is a big part of the problem is just our modern world is so focused on a certain look. We see it in magazines and advertisements, television and movies. And people look a certain way and they say, that's the look that I want. I'll do whatever I have to get that look. Also, this idea that every person out there needs to kind of take this commando style approach and take their fitness to an extreme. Your part of your role as a trainer is to say, okay, let's get the expectations in a more realistic realm and understand what are we trying to actually accomplish by incorporating exercise into your life.
Exactly. Let's tamper it down a little bit. Let's get real. And, you know, we can look at a picture of Arnold and in all reality, that's a false image because it's not a healthy image. There's all kinds of things going on that people don't understand. You know, people use drugs. They use all kinds of chemical means of enhancements. And I get it. That's the business. But that's not the normal person. And those pictures, the posters are up in gyms and they're up in studios. And what really happens is that people now go into the studio and they just pound that treadmill for 2 hours and then they kickbox themselves into a dizzy sweat. You know, because they think the more that I do, I'm going to end up looking like this. But what happens is that people don't eat properly and they put in way too much time. So they're actually robbing their body of key nutrients. They don't have an understanding that they have to feed themselves better as well. And there's the main driving point behind that's the crux of the problem. when we talk about, I want to look almost perfect, I want this weight loss, I want to have a waist of under 30 inches, I want broad shoulders, you know, that's an image presented to them. But I always ask, how much work are you willing to put into it? Are you really willing to work out like an Olympic athlete to get that? Because that's what you have to do. That's the reality behind that. And then my next question is, how long are you willing to do that? How long will your body last? Because 6-week boot camps are meaningless and they're all over the place. But that's what people believe they need. You know, let's just run up the hill 40 times until we pass out. And that's really, really cool to lie there in the grass, heaving and hardly able to move the next day.
So let's talk about weight loss for a bit, because I'm sure that that's one reason why a lot of people would come say, I want to get rid of this weight. And so tell me how to do that through exercise.
Well, weight loss is the key. In my business, it's 98% people come in and say, look, I want weight loss. The other, there's some therapy and I want to gain strength and balance or sports related. But wow, weight loss is the one. So then I have to say, look, you know, I can tell you that this exercise will do it, but I'm going to tell you the truth now. I mean, as a nutritionist, I have to give you the information, say you're going to have to change things at home as well. So when you leave, here's a plan. Here's how you eat. Here's how to set in place laws of nutrition that the body wants to achieve balance. Because we can't just push the body to an extreme with exercise and then stay on the same path of unhealthy eating. Because what that does is you get stronger and you might build some muscle, but you just won't show it. I mean, to really bring down the levels of weight that some people really need, 60, 70 pounds, it can't be done without good, tight nutrition. And by that, I mean just healthy eating, whole foods rather than refined foods. Mm-hmm. And that just means, and people are actually different. I can have one person that might be sensitive to carbohydrates and another person needs more carbohydrates. So we have to find that out as nutritionists. Not everybody is the same. But most people overeat carbohydrates, sugars, unhealthy fats.
And but the fact is that people tend to overemphasize the role of exercise in weight loss and underappreciate the role of nutrition.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I imagine this is not a popular message to a group of people that tend to, we've kind of all been conditioned to think of these quick fixes and this sort of take the pill and you can live how you want, or you go do the intense workout for an hour and then you can go back to your cheesecake and whatever else you want to do. Your message is, sorry, folks, we have to have a long-term approach and we have to prioritize consistency.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, I preach the unpopular message right from the beginning. And if somebody leaves, you know, that's fine. If you're not a client that wants real results, and if you want to be deceived, if you want to hear a message that deceives you, you go ahead and go next door. If you come up the stairs to my place, I'm going to tell you what's unpopular, but what works. And it works 100% of the time if people listen, because they're really just, it's like the law of gravity. We know it works. I'll drop an apple from a cliff. If you're underneath it, you're going to get it on top of the head. It works. The law of gravity exists. Well, the laws of health are just as real. If I eat McDonald's all day long, I mean, in 4 weeks, I'm going to have quite the punch around my middle. My heart's going to suffer. So the body likes balance. Junk food doesn't create balance, just as too much exercise does not create balance either. We have to find a middle ground. So when we look at today, we're looking at a $3.2 trillion healthcare expenditure. $3.2 trillion. So we're looking at
this
extreme.
Is this in America? Is this Canada? Is this global? What is this?
Well, it's America. I'm sorry. So
$3.2 trillion.
People where the fitness industry is really catching on in a subset of society, but it's being done to an extreme. And then we see the other end of the extreme where we see healthcare exploding because people are really not, they're very sedentary. So what's the middle ground here? Should we do this exercise until our joints wear out? You know, should we do 10 years of just crazy ballistic exercise and then not eat right, which really leads us into the having to depend on the healthcare system at the end anyways? Because as we were talking about earlier, what happens is we do have sort of a throwaway society we seem to think that if something doesn't work, well, just throw it away. And we can get kneecaps replaced, you know, hips replaced, back surgery. And we say, well, we're just as good as new. That's not true. And I can tell you that because if you've got your knees replaced, you're not doing those deep lunges anymore. You still do have pain. You have risks of infection and rejection of the parts.
So you have to take the approach of this is the body God gave me, and I need to take care of it for the long term to make it last and do as much, you know, keep me around for as long as possible, and not have this idea that, well, I can get some synthetic replacements and I should be good to go. This is this is basically the approach that you're talking about with what should the goal be with exercise.
Right. So are we looking at instant solution or are we looking at maintenance? That is the key to, and this idea of maintenance for the human body is almost unheard of today. I mean, I talk to people all day long and I say, well, why do you exercise? Well, they're not saying I'm exercising because when I'm 80, I want to be strong and I want to have balance and I want to have coordination and I want to be able to lift things up into the cupboard. Mm-hmm. They want to look good today.
Right.
It's instant solutions for the next year. That's as far as people look.
So this sort of long-term approach, let's get to some brass tacks here. What are some of the, say, fundamental principles? If you're going to have this long-term approach and you're trying to basically set yourself up for good quality of life into your later years, what are some of the bedrock principles that you're going to be relying on?
Right. So that's easy enough. I mean, government guidelines give us the time that we need. The American College of Sports Medicine says, you know, you need 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise a week. And that's what we call a maintenance. You can do more than that. So if you do 30 to 60 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, that's about the same a week as 20 to 60 minutes, three times a week of vigorous intensity exercises.
Okay, can you just define moderate versus vigorous intensity? What are we talking about? You said you don't want to, you do the hill sprints where you're heaving on the ground. That's bad, I'm guessing, or a certain amount of that's okay, but just not too much, or what would you say?
Right. It's in any amount. So moderate intensity raises your heart rate, and then you start a light sweat, and then that would include walking, swimming, riding a bike, pushing a lawnmower, or playing actively with your children. And for a lot of people, that's enough. And especially if you're getting older or you have injuries or, you know, you just don't want to get into that hard exercise. Just make sure that you're getting your 150 minutes of that a week. If you're getting into vigorous exercise, then, of course, we should tamper down a little bit because your heart rate is going to increase and you're going to sweat profusely. So those are different types of exercises. So what we're looking at is aerobics or circuit training with weights, sprinting, hill climbing, hill running, interval training, good game of basketball, hockey, things like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. However, time frame wise, we don't need 2 hours of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I train clients, 45 minutes and they're begging to leave. And quite frankly, that's a lot of exercise vigorously because mm-hmm. your heart rate really is pushing, you know, 150, 160 beats per minute at certain points of exercise or even higher. So you don't need to be extreme for long periods of time. And that's what I meant by that.
Mm-hmm. What about strength training versus resistance training versus more of the exercise that's intended specifically to elevate the heart rate and get the breath going?
Both are beneficial. So we do want the cardiovascular effect. We do want to walk. We do want, some people like running. Go ahead. If you have to do an in-between, do a walk, jog. Those are very effective. And studies show they're just as effective as running, and they save the knees a lot more. And then you can also, and I would really recommend to listeners that they do strength training. You should combine the two. So you can take a day of cardio and then you can take a day of strength training, or you could combine the two every day, which mm-hmm. is what I do really. My exercises are combined and my heart rate is raised. I will do a cardio exercise and then I'll do a strength exercise, or I will do a strength exercise to raise my heart rate to cardio effect. Yeah. The difference though is to use that intensity wisely, not compulsively. There's the difference today. Compulsive people can't stop. A little is good. A lot must be better. You know, and we see that everywhere. And that's just simply not true. If you, I mean, maximum an hour, if you can go more than that, you're simply not working out hard enough.
So what would you say would be some of the symptoms of overtraining the person who might be overdoing it on the intensity side of things?
Well, overtraining is, you know, we used to say very few people can achieve that. Today, people do achieve it, and you'll see it in different ways. One is how your body reacts to the overtraining over a period of time. I mean, you lose sleep, you get cranky, you're irritable, you have all kinds of illness that can pop up, headaches. And people sometimes don't recognize that their nervous system is just hit far too hard and their muscles have no recovery. You know, and the other factor in overtraining has to do with the joints and the muscles. There is such a thing as being sore the next day, and I'm a big proponent of that because, you know, you're looking to gain lean muscle. But what's sore? Is it your muscles or your joints? Mm-hmm. If your knees are hurting or your shoulder is aching every time you do something, you're probably overdoing an exercise. So you have to go back and analyze what you're doing. How am I doing my lifts? How fast am I doing it? Do I have proper form, tempo? Mm-hmm. You know, analyze what you're doing and don't just take a magazine article and say, well, this is for a 250-pound bodybuilder. That looks good enough for me. But yet, you know, a person might be 150 pounds.
One more question. Someone asked me recently, okay, I just started this this exercise regimen and I find that it's making me foggy at work. I'm making mistakes. I feel drained for the rest of the day. You know, what am I doing wrong? And I was just thinking about there is overtraining, there is maybe overdoing it, but there's also an adaptation that has to happen where it seems like often you have to kind of get over this initial hump of your body getting used to a certain level of work that, and be willing to put up with a certain amount of that discomfort in the short term, as you're finding that sweet spot where it's helping you and not hurting you. What are your
That's
thoughts?
That's exactly right. You might go from a sedentary person to one that does exercise and the body does adapt. So then you ask yourself, am I doing it correctly? If I'm doing it correctly, I'm not overdoing it, and I'm feeling it like that, then yes, the body's adapting. It's somewhat like nutrition. You go from somebody eating junk food to somebody eating a lot of vegetables. It's what we call a die-off effect. And then they call me and they say, you're killing me. You know? No, I said, no, you're just, your body's purging toxins. So there's going to be a period of 7 to 10 days when you feel like you're really not feeling good. Same with exercise. The body gets used to it. And we really have to feel a certain tiredness to gain energy. That's the way our body works. We have to work hard to feel good. That initial working hard period, if you're not used to it, will make you feel like you think you're dying sometimes, but you're not. It depends how sedentary you are. And I always caution people, start slow.
Right.
Start so you don't feel too bad, and then just work your way into that.
We've been talking with personal trainer and nutritionist Jörg Mardian about the real purpose of exercise and how to exercise in a way that's going to have long-term benefits and avoid some of the pitfalls and the misconceptions that so many of us fall into. He's writing an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Jörg, as always, we really appreciate your insights and your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
America's presidential election was very divided, but if there was one thing that people agreed on, it was actually character had no place on the presidential ballot. The question that people really wanted answered was who's going to give the nation the right mix of jobs and taxes and bombs. The candidates were pressed on economic policy and tax policy, trade policy, defense policy. But what about the candidates' character? What we saw in this election was the logical result of voters having some time ago rejected the foundation of true leadership, that is, the ability to lead yourself. The Bible talks about qualities required in leaders of families and cities and nations. And, you know, it almost completely ignores job creation, policy, sophistication, military administration. It focuses almost completely on one thing, and that is personal character. Now, these presidential candidates, they were occasionally referred to, were they fit for office, were they presidential, and so on. But that was really a sideshow to the qualifications that in voters' minds really mattered. But the Bible, by contrast, says that personal character is the qualification that really matters. And this is a lesson that so many in authority have never learned. And as a result, they're really making a mess of this world. Proverbs 25, verse 28 says, "He that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls." So that's where rulership must start, ruling your own spirit. You have to govern yourself. Millions of people today believe that weak personal character has nothing to do with a leader's success. But God knows that weak character disqualifies someone for high office. If a man can't rule himself, how can he rule others? Jesus said, "If the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch." The Apostle Paul, talking to young men who are looking ahead to having a family, forging a career, taking their place as contributors and builders of society, he said to these young men, "Urge them to control themselves." You can find that in Titus 2 and verse 6. The Moffat translation says, "Tell the young men also to be masters of themselves at all points." Someone who lacks self-control renders himself unfit to lead in many ways. He caves into peer pressure easily. He's too concerned about what others think of him. He prioritizes appearance over substance. That leads to forms of cheating, corner cutting. He's susceptible to unsound judgment, to favoritism, partiality, unpredictability. He wrestles with feelings of depression and inferiority. He gets jealous easily, especially when someone around him succeeds. He can become terribly manipulative and political. He loses his temper. He acts arrogantly, even tyrannically, in order to mask his insecurities. He does self-destructive things and succumbs to bad influences. He has difficulty controlling his own passions and lusts. The more authority that person has, the more damage he can do to more people. But someone who truly conquers himself and successfully administers his own self-rule, he can successfully take on more and more authority. He can do more and more good for more and more people. Proverbs 16, verse 32 says, "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit better than he that takes a city." Christ also said, "If you're faithful in small matters, you will be faithful in the big ones." Learn to really govern yourself. Then you can influence your family, your country, your world. It'll start to unlock your potential for leadership and genuine success. Here's another proverb about godly leadership. "Mercy and truth preserve the king, and by loving kindness he upholds his throne." That's Proverbs 20, verse 28. Truth, loving kindness. The Living Bible says, "If a king is kind, honest, and fair, his kingdom stands secure." Now, if you asked 100 world leaders to list the most important qualities contributing to the longevity of a kingdom, how many would say, well, honesty and loving kindness, those are at the top of the list? The fact is that the Bible trains people in a different type of government. It's a government that works. God doesn't call the governors of this world with all of their expertise, all of their experience. They can't solve the problems. They can't make people's lives better. But if you want to see how to start building a government that actually works, read the scriptural instruction God outlines in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, where he talks about leaders being individuals who rule themselves by submitting to God. Then they rule those who follow them. They rule them by serving them. The qualifications for leadership espoused by the Bible are vastly different than those used in our politics today. But you know what? So are the results. Thank you. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. We'd like you to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Brent Noctegal, Chris Eames, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson. A democracy is nothing more than mob rule, where 51% of the people may take away the rights of the other 49. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.